listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Hello, kitties, and welcome to my world. I would come over and say hello to you, but it's just as easy for you to come to me. Yes, yes, come in. You've come to the right place. This is where you'll learn everything there is to know about your furry feline friends. I'm talking about cats. Yes, I know, we are positively perfect pets. What do you mean I have attitude? Why, of course I do. I'm a cat. It's called Catitude. As I was saying, this show is all about cats. Cats, and, cats! So let me introduce you to my accomplice, assistant and host of Catitude, Tom Doc. Okay, Tom, tell them how wonderful we cats are. It's okay, you have my permission.
Welcome to the Catitude channel on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Tom Doc, and I'm very glad to be back here with you again today. And we're doing a show today that is really a long time in coming. I realized earlier this week that I mentioned a certain breed of cat early in one of my shows, and I think the second show when we were talking about Persians, and we never really got around to talking about them, and these cats really deserve their own show. So we're going to be talking about this breed today, a breed that one breeder has said is much more enterprising than their solid-colored cousins, the Persians, and they provide rescue for owners who have previously endured the domineering ways and the boisterous affections of the Siamese cats. Well, if you haven't figured it out by now, we're talking about the cross between Siamese and Persians, and that's the Himalayan cat. This is one of the early man-made or man-developed breeds. We talked about the Bengal cat in our last show and how man has developed, how humans have developed this breed of cat. The Himalayans were actually one of the first man-developed breeds. Now, we all know that even the Siamese, as ancient as they are, and the Abyssinians and the Persians, as old as they are, got a lot of help to get to where they are today through our own selective breeding process. We chose the mates for the cats to perfect the traits that we wanted to see in these breeds. But what I'm talking about is not taking an older breed that was already there and working with it. We're talking about coming up with something brand new, like they did with the Bengal cats and like they did with the Himalayans back early in the 20th century. And we'll talk about the history of that and how that came about when we come back from our break, as well as give you all of the skinny on the Himalayan cats, everything that you need to know about them. We'll meet some famous Himalayan cats. And then after our midway break, we're going to spend some time talking about some legislation that's going across the United States right now. It's becoming more and more popular, and that is the mandatory spay and neuter legislation that a lot of cities are enacting in order to try to control their pet overpopulation problems. We'll talk about whether that's a good idea or not, and hopefully maybe even generate some emails. As always, remember, you can email me at tom@petliferadio.com. I love your suggestions. Lots of people will email in and even send me pictures of their cats, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. Well, we need to take our first break right now and hear from our sponsors, but as always, let's give you a little trivia question to think about during the break. There were two movies in the 1990s that featured a Himalayan cat named Sassy, and if I remember right, I believe Sassy was a Seal Point Himalayan, and these movies, called Homeward Bound and Homeward Bound 2, were basically movies about three animals that had to travel and catch up with their family again. My question to you is, in these movies and in both movies, who was the voice of the Himalayan cat Sassy? That's for you to think about, and we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Ooh, do I hear a can being opened? I believe I smell tuna. Catitude will return after these messages. That should give me enough time to investigate what's going on in the kitchen. Don't have a hissy fit. We'll be right back.
I love cleaning the litter box, said no one ever. Luckily, there's World's Best Cat Litter, the litter that promises less mess with less litter. Only World's Best Cat Litter uses the concentrated power of corn to quickly trap odors in tight clumps. And quick clumping means you never have to chisel or scrape the box. Less cleanup with less wasted litter? That's a litter bit amazing. Save $2 on World's Best Cat Litter. Visit www.saveonworldsbest.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
How dare they open a can of tuna and make a sandwich out of it? I can see why some of my celebrity pals prefer lasagna. Well, anyway, I did manage to grab myself the canary while I was in there. Quiet, bird. We're going to hear the rest of my show, Catitude. If you behave, I may not eat you. Until later. Okay, Tom, you may continue.
And we're back to Catitude on the Pet Life Radio. And I had a trivia question for you about a Himalayan cat in the Homeward Bound movies. Her name was Sassy, but her voice was done by a famous actress. And did you know who that was? Well, the actress is Sally Field, one of my favorite actresses, somebody that I've kind of grown up with in many TV shows and movies during my time. And actually, she can be seen on a pretty decent ABC show on Sunday nights now called Brothers and Sisters, which I actually really enjoy. My wife and I enjoy watching that. And as always, she's a very talented actress. She's the one that did the voice in both of the Homeward Bound movies for Sassy the Cat. So we're going to focus in on our Himalayan kitties today. And Himalayans is the term for pointed Persians here in the United States. If you go over to Europe, they're going to be known as color point long hairs. And these cats are all shown in the Persian class, and I'll get to why that is in just a few minutes. But let me tell you a little bit about the history of the Himalayans and how they came to be. As I said, a lot of breeders, especially when they first saw the Siamese and when they first saw the Persians, imagined what it would be like to have those color points of the Siamese, that pattern, on a Persian cat with that hair and that body type. And people were thinking about this even way back in the 1880s. But nothing was really done until about the 1920s and even into the 1930s, when here in America, two Harvard medical school workers, one of which was also a cat breeder, started mating Siamese with Persians. And they used several different types of Persians. They used smoke Persians and silver tabbies and black Persians. And what they were trying to do was not necessarily at that point in time create a new breed of cat, but they were actually just trying to understand how genetics worked. Now, keep in mind, you know, here we are 80 years removed from these people. We didn't know that DNA was the genetic material until the 1950s. And also keep in mind that these folks working in the 1920s and 1930s were not that far removed from the work of Gregor Mendel, who's the Austrian monk who did the work with peas and everything and is really considered to be the father of genetics. He's the one that coined the phrase or coined the term gene. And so a lot of people did not know how these things were inherited, how Siamese were Siamese and how Persians were Persians. And so that was the work of these two Harvard medical school workers. And they, of course, mated these Siamese with Persians. And then they took that generation, that F1 generation. And if you remember from last time that we talked, when we were talking about Bengal cats, that F1 generation is the filial one generation. It's the first generation after the initial cross. They mated those cats together. So in other words, you've got that initial generation, the kids were mated together to create a third generation. And out of that third generation, the F2 generation, was a long-haired black female. Now, this long-haired black female was bred back to one of the F1 generation males, and she gave birth to a little female kitten named Debutante. And Debutante was the very first pointed long-haired cat here in the United States. Well, that point in time, and that was back in 1935, so it took them roughly somewhere between, oh, I would say 5 and 8 years to get to debutante. Now, at this point in time, the folks at Harvard, they said, okay, we're done. We've got the information that we need to understand how inheritance works and how genetics works, or at least whatever they were trying to determine at that point in time. But over in Britain, a lot of these experimental breeders over in Britain looked at debutante and they thought, wow, this is a pretty neat cat, but she was really too Siamese in her shape. And in a couple shows, we'll talk about Balinese cats, and Balinese are actual long-haired Siamese. They've got the Siamese shape. Everything about them is Siamese with the exception of they have that long-haired gene. Again, remember, we're talking about one recessive gene here for the long hair. The British breeders, of course, like their cobby cats, and so they started working on trying to get that color point in a cat that was stocky and cobby, like their Persians that they wanted. And there was a gentleman by the name of Brian Sterling Webb, and he spent about 10 years perfecting this long-haired color point. And really, in 1947, roughly, is when this key point was reached over in Britain. And about that same time, now we're after World War II, you know, things are kind of calming down a little bit, interest picked up again in America. And of course, the Britons had been working with this all along. And in 1955, this Brian Sterling Webb actually approached the Governing Council of the Cat Fancy, which is the group over in Britain that oversees all the cat associations and cat breed shows. He wanted recognition for this color point long hair. And he got it in 1955. And the same thing happened in 1957 when a Ms. Goforth here in North America went to the CFA annual meeting and she said, hey, I've got this color point long hair. We're calling it a Himalayan and we want to be able to show it. And in 1961, all of the major cat associations recognized Himalayans as they're known here in the United States, color point Persians over in the, or color point long hairs over in Europe. And over this past 50 years or so, almost 500,000 Himalayans have been registered. And that's absolutely amazing. That's like 10,000 cats a year. So obviously this is a very popular breed. They haven't really cracked the top 10 most of the time. But when you look at these pictures, and I advise you, please go to the CFA website, cfa.org, and click on the breed article about Himalayans. You will see several instances or several examples of just absolutely gorgeous cats. The one at the top of the page is Oak Heaven's Hook, Line, and Sinker, and it's a seal lynx point. And we'll talk about these colors in just a few minutes. But you can see the Persian in the cat, but you also see that they have the points. There's a flame point down about the middle of the page, Mayberry's Majestic Light. It's a male flame point, very, very good looking cat, very striking in how the red shows off the blue and the white in the cat. And on the front page, well, not the front page, but on the page that shows all the champion cats, there's a blue point Persian. He is the sixth best cat, and just you'll be amazed when you look at him and just see how pretty these cats are. They are just absolutely fabulous. And you can see why early breeders really wanted to get those color point patterns into the Persian body. It's just really an amazing thing that they did. So as I've said, these are Persian cats, and they were actually shown in their own division. They were shown as Himalayans up until about the 1980s. And what was happening is, again, we're dealing with a very small gene pool here. And as Himalayans were crossed to Himalayans, more of the Siamese traits were coming out. And so you got a longer cat, a cat with a longer nose. And that is not what the breeders wanted. So a lot of outcrossing went back and they started outcrossing to Persians. And so you've got Persians now being mixed into the Himalayan bloodlines. And at some point, I believe it was about 1984, the Persian Breed Council of the CFA and the Himalayan Breed Council of the CFA basically asked their members, should we incorporate Himalayans into the Persian division, or should Himalayans continue to be shown as is? Well, both groups, interestingly, said keep it as is, keep the Himalayans separate from the Persians, but the CFA Board of Directors that year said, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to move the Himalayans into the Persian breed. They are a division of the Persian class. And their rationale was basically that there was consistency then to the breed structure. And the reason they did that was cats like bicolor Persians had short hairs in their pedigrees, but they were shown as Persians. And so even though the Himalayans had Siamese in their background, they wanted to show them as Persians. And now, if you get a Himalayan cat, a CFA registered Himalayan cat, it has to show only Persians and Himalayans in the pedigree. There can be no Siamese at all in the pedigree. And I think what we've seen now, it was actually a pretty wise move back there in 1984 to put the Himalayans in with the Persians, simply because now we've got that striking cat that is not getting elongated and not looking more like a Balinese cat. As far as their colors go, they can be shown in a variety of colors. You know, we talk about the Siamese only being shown in the seal blue, chocolate, and lilac points. Well, Himalayans can be shown in those colors. But in 1964, the flame points and tortie point cats were added as well. And these cats came about because of some of the red Persians that were involved. And like I said, if you see a flame point Persian, they're pretty striking. You're not going to forget that cat. The way that the red plays off the blue eyes and the cream white body, it's just a very striking combination. In fact, some breeders consider the flame points and the tortie points to really be kind of the darlings of the Himalayan world. So it's a big contrast. There were some blue creams and cream points added in the 1970s as far as what they could show, and lynx points were actually added in 1982. And these are actually very sought after colors as well. Interesting thing about the Himalayans, we talk about the chocolate points and the lilac points in both the Siamese and the Himalayans. Chocolates and lilacs are actually very difficult to breed true because of all the recessive traits that you have. Not only the recessive trait for the pointed cat, but chocolate is recessive itself, and lilac is recessive even to chocolate. And this gets kind of confusing with all the different alleles and everything, but it's hard to get a really good looking chocolate cat. Himalayans also have a little bit of an issue because you're not going to see the deep, rich colors of the points that you see in the Siamese in most cases. And this is because of their Persian background. They've got those little flat, short noses, and that actually retains a lot of heat. And as you remember from our Siamese show, you've got to have the cooler extremities to get the strong coloration. And that's why the tails and the feet and the ear tips are always colored. The nose of the Himalayan a lot of time is not going to be as strongly colored as a Siamese of the same color. But that's something that the breeders are working on, and hopefully they'll get away from the really short pugged face cats and maybe allow that nose to come out a little bit. But otherwise, a Himalayan should look like a Persian other than the coloration. Small ears, the wide, massive head, the short legs, short nose, short tail, and the cobby, just powerful, powerful body. At the top of the show, I mentioned their personality, how they were good because they were more energetic than the Persians, but not quite as boisterous as the Siamese. And these cats are very playful, but they don't tend to be very demanding. They do want to be around you. They are very people-oriented, but the way that I would contrast to compare that is if you're working on something like I'm working on the computer right now, your Siamese cat's going to want to be there helping you type that. The Himalayan is going to sit there and probably just edit it for you. Just look back and maybe make some critiques of what you're typing. We know that with these long-haired cats, grooming is a must. So if you're going to get a Himalayan cat, please be prepared to brush them every day. Health-wise, they're going to run into the same type of problems that our Persians run into. One of the big problems, of course, is polycystic kidney disease. And I talked about that with Persians. Since Himalayans are truly Persians, you're going to see about 40% of Himalayans will come down with polycystic kidney disease. The sad thing about this is often you're not going to know this until much later in the cat's life. And if you're a breeder, if you want to breed, you may have unwittingly allowed this cat who's carrying this disease to breed further into your cat population. So you can get a genetic test done at the University of California at Davis. They have a genetics section there, and they can do a test for polycystic kidney disease. So that is something that should be done. And of course, then neuter that animal, spay that animal, so that they do not continue to pass that on. Again, 40% of our Himmies are going to show up with polycystic kidney disease. Other concerns that we see also, the progressive retinal atrophy, which breeders are working hard to try to breed out of the population of Himalayans, and any short nose problems. Just like the Persian cats, you're going to have clogged tear ducts, you're going to have breathing difficulties because of the short nose. So we definitely want to try to talk with our breeders and look for cats that have a little bit of an elongated nose as well. Now, I mentioned earlier a couple of the famous Himalayans. Sassy from the Homeward Bound movies, who was voiced by Sally Field. Mr. Jinx from the Meet the Parents movies, both Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers. You remember Mr. Jinx, he was getting in lots of problems and causing lots of issues, especially when they went down and met the Fockers, and there's a little Chihuahua dog that was running around. I think he actually flushed the Chihuahua dog at some point in time. In the parody movie, date movie, Mr. Jinkers was the contrast to Mr. Jinx and Meet the Parents because they were doing a parody of Meet the Parents. And also, for those of you who are interested, Martha Stewart has 7 Himalayans, and she's named them all after famous composers like Beethoven and Bach. She has them featured on her show, and I believe that they've also been featured in some of her Kmart commercials as well. So those are some of our famous Himalayans, and that's a little bit of a breed history for you here. We need to take another quick break and let you know what our sponsors have to say. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something that's really rolling across the United States right now in an effort to try to control pet overpopulation, and that is mandatory spay and neuter laws. We'll talk about those, whether or not they're a good idea, and things that we can do as cat lovers, cat breeders, to help control the pet population and keep all of our feline friends safe. So we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Ooh, do I hear a can being opened? I believe I smell tuna. Catitude will return after these messages. That should give me enough time to investigate what's going on in the kitchen. Don't have a hissy fit. We'll be right back.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your Cat Tree Tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
How dare they open a can of tuna and make a sandwich out of it? I can see why some of my celebrity pals prefer lasagna. Well, anyway, I did manage to grab myself the canary while I was in there. Quiet bird, we're going to hear the rest of my show, Catitude. If you behave, I may not eat you. Until later. Okay, Tom, you may continue.
And we are back to the Catitude Channel on Pet Life Radio. Thanks for hanging in there with us today, and I hope that you're learning a lot, not only about the Himalayan breed of cat, but also what's going on in the pet world. Now, as you all know, I'm a reporter for the Veterinary News Network, and I do a lot of research during my free time into animal legislation that is going on across the United States. And one thing that is happening and really kind of came to the forefront when Los Angeles did this back in February, and that is the use of mandatory spay and neuter legislation to help control pet overpopulation. And for those of you who don't know about this, the theory is that if we require sterilization or neutering of all pets in an area, then the numbers of unwanted pets will actually decrease. And, you know, that sounds really, really good. And so we started looking into some things at the news network, started looking at how has this really affected shelter populations, how has it affected euthanasias in that area, in those areas where it's happened. And just so you're aware, the state of Rhode Island requires mandatory spay and neutering, and there's about 30 cities, 30 towns across the United States that either mandate spay and neutering your pet by a certain age, usually 6 months, or they put restrictions on breeding animals. In other words, if you want to breed, you've got to have a special license, you have to pay a higher fee, you have to pay that on a yearly basis, on and on and on. Now, what makes this so newsworthy right now is that dozens of cities this year are considering this type of legislation. Cities such as Chicago and Dallas are considering that, and I'm sure that it'll be back on the ballot at the California state legislature at the state level. It was last year, and it got pulled off because of opposition to it, but I bet with LA making their spays and neuters mandatory, I bet it's probably going to go back on the ballot. Now, just so you're aware, just some numbers. We'll talk about dogs first. One pair of dogs can be responsible for more than 67,000 puppies in just six generations. So that's about 3.5-4 years. Certainly no more than 5 years. 67,000 puppies. Unfortunately, for us cat lovers, a single pair of cats can be responsible for more than 420,000 kittens in that same time frame. And of course, you know, for me, that's almost a point of, it's almost something that I'm proud of, because cats are so good at reproducing. It makes me think about how they've been evolutionarily designed to survive. But of course, when we put it in context of pet overpopulation, it's not a good thing. A pair of cats responsible for more than 400,000 kittens in about a 3.5 to 4 year period of time. We also know that somewhere between 4 and 8 million animals are euthanized in shelters every year. And 70% of those cats that go into shelters will end up being euthanized. And I can speak to this myself, having worked in an animal shelter here in Indiana. It's a rural animal shelter, and cats would come in, you know, we'd pick up these stray cats, and it was a very rare day when somebody would want to come in and adopt a cat. Sometimes we get kittens adopted. We often would have specials. I hate to say that, but if you adopted one cat, you got another one free type of thing, because it was just such a sad state of affairs that we could not adopt out these cats. But in a rural area, it was very easy for people to get cats. And so, you know, coming up to the shelter to look for a cat was not something that they did. Now, again, these mandatory spay and neuter laws, their goal is to reduce the number of animals that are surrendered to shelters, therefore reducing the number of euthanasias. Unfortunately, these laws are not producing the results that they are expected. We've actually seen in the cities that have enacted this mandatory spay and neuter legislation. Now, we're talking about overall spay and neutering. This is, you don't have a choice. You get your dog spayed or neutered, or you pay fines, or you do jail time or community service or things like that, unless you get a breeding license. These are, everybody has to get their animals spayed or neutered. Licensing has declined. If you're in an area where you have to get your dog or your cat licensed, when mandatory spay neuter legislation comes along, licensing goes down because people don't want the government to know that they've got pets. More pets are actually surrendered to shelters because people don't want to put up with the cost of having to spay or neuter them. In the case where proponents of mandatory spay-neuter legislation say, hey, look, euthanasias at our shelters went down, you can go back a few years and actually find that the decline in euthanasias was happening prior to the enaction of the mandatory spay-neuter legislation. And so basically what's happening is they're not having the effect that they thought they would have. In King County, Washington, that's around Seattle, they did a mandatory spay neuter, and it actually increased the cost of running their animal control from $1.6 million in 1990 to more than $3 million in 1997. And the revenues aren't keeping pace with this. So this is what we've got. Right now, we've got more people decide not to license their pets, more pets enter the shelters, euthanasia rates actually slow down, but it slows down the decline. In other words, you had a stronger decline, a faster slowdown, if you will, before the enaction of these type of ordinances. Now, can this work? Because I don't want you guys sitting out there listening going, oh my gosh, Tom, you know, you're an idiot. We have too many pets out there as it is. I agree, there is a pet overpopulation problem, and having worked in shelters, I know what an issue it is and how sad it can really be. But what you've got to realize is work can be done without mandating that everybody go out and spay and neuter their animal at a certain point in time. In Tacoma, Washington, and in St. Louis, Missouri, spay and neuter laws have worked, but these cities have targeted pet owners who repeatedly allow their pets to roam free, or pets who have been involved in bites. And that's where I think we really need to look at how mandatory spay and neuter can work. And that is spay and neutering the animals of people who are irresponsible, who allow their pets to roam free. We'll also see that states and cities who have invested in subsidizing spay and neuter programs, these programs help low-income families. We've seen huge results in this type of thing where you go to a place and you can get your dog or cat spayed at a reduced price, and we do see fewer animals surrendered and fewer euthanasias in that case. And I guess my whole point in all of this is thinking that mandatory spay and neuter is going to be a good cure-all for the pet overpopulation problem, that's not going to work. It's shown not to work. It actually, a lot of places out in Maryland, out in Missouri, North Dakota, a few other places that had mandatory spay and neuters have repealed them. They've said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And there are some health concerns, too, that we need to look at, especially for some of these cities that are mandating spaying or neutering dogs and cats before they're 4 months old. Not waiting till 6 months, but saying they have to be spayed or neutered by the time they're 4 months old. And some veterinarians are very concerned that we might be setting our dogs up for more problems, including things like cruciate tears, problems with the urinary tract, lots of different things. I don't have enough time to go into all of these right now, but a lot more work needs to be done, and you really need to understand the facts before you agree that mandatory spay-neuter is going to work in your city. So if that comes about, if you find out that your local city council, your county government is thinking about mandating spaying and neutering for all animals, you need to think twice about that. And certainly shoot me an email if you want to learn some more information. I can give you some great websites about these type of things and how they may or may not work. Pet overpopulation is a multifaceted problem, and it's going to take a multifaceted solution to fix it. And we all want to make sure that we do the best for the animals that are out there, but telling people that they have to spay and neuter their pets is probably not the best way to go about it. Well, kind of got off on a real serious note there, but it is something that we need to talk about. And we're going to come back next time and discuss another breed of cats. Maybe we'll go into the Balinese and the Burmans, or maybe start looking at the Angoras. There's still several breeds out there that we need to discuss. As always, if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you just want to learn more about what's going on with any of this.
Want to know what cats like to eat for breakfast? Mice Krispies, of course. Learn everything there is to know about cats on Catitude with your host, Tom Dock. Each week, we'll spotlight a cool cat breed, give up-to-date advice on cat health, and check out spiffy new cat products. So curl up on the couch every week for a perfectly enjoyable time on Catitude. Every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.